Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has examined the consequences and realities of the American court system from the broken windows theory of police tactics. This is where police target misdemeanor crimes in high crime neighborhoods. In New York City's much heralded trial in the 1990s and early 2000s, misdemeanor arrests increased by 80%. Now, crime did decrease during that period, but so did crime nationwide, regardless of whether police departments were using the broken windows tactics. And the effectiveness of the strategy is still much in question. But what's not in doubt is how New York court system reacted. It was unequipped and ill-equipped to handle such an increase in volume. Issa Kohler-Hausman has researched the system's struggle to deal with this strategy, has written about her findings in the forthcoming book, Misdemeanor Land, Criminal Courts and Social Control in the Age of Broken Windows. Kohler-Hausman is an associate professor of law at Yale Law School and associate professor of sociology at Yale University. She'll be giving the 10th Stephanie Seymour Lecture in Law at the University of Tulsa's College of Law this Thursday on Detecting Discrimination, Some Thoughts on Theory and Method. She'll be speaking Thursday at 6 o'clock at the law school, and the lecture is free and open to the public. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Issa Kohler-Hausman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, the broken windows New York policing strategy received an awful lot of attention during the 1990s for its role in allegedly bringing down crime in New York City. But a lot of people have been looking in the last decade or so at the effectiveness of that strategy and whether it's led to some of the contemporary issues in policing that we're experiencing across America today. What led you to investigate the effectiveness of using mass misdemeanor arrests as a policing strategy?
Well, to be honest, in the interest of full disclosure, that my work doesn't actually investigate that specific question, which is whether or not broken windows policing causes, in some, you know, clear, direct sense, crime reductions. I was more interested in what happens to all these people after they're arrested, after the point of a street encounter. What do criminal courts do with the massive influx of arrests that happen, you know, as part of this policing experiment? And I found that interesting for two reasons. First, in the era of mass incarceration, almost everyone was looking at the sort of high end of the criminal justice system, right? The sort of tip of what, you know, many people often referred to as the penal pyramid, because, you know, it alliterates. And they've looked at what are the effects of mass incarceration, what are the causes, what are the social implications of this strategy. But if you think about it, prison is actually quite rare, even for felony arrests, and most arrests are not felony arrests. Most encounters are street encounters. Most arrests are for sub-felony offenses, whether it be municipal offenses or misdemeanor crimes. So I was interested in what's happening in the much larger and more neglected part. And I started this project about 10 years ago, before Ferguson, before I think there actually had been some public media attention on this. And secondly, the Broken Windows experiment was largely framed in terms of a policing intervention, right? I mean, the original article made sort of two claims. One is that people really cared about order enforcement in and of itself, and the other was that enforcing low-level crimes would bring down major street crime. But no one thought what would happen when you engage in a policing initiative that essentially doubled, or, you know, I think it was an 80% increase in number of these low-level arrests. And so there's an interesting sort of theoretical question also, which is, what do people deserve for jumping the turnstile or urinating in public or petty larceny, you know, doing some shoplifting of goods that aren't worth, you know, more than a couple hundred dollars, usually often $5 or $1. And so it's an interesting sort of philosophical question, which is how do actors deal with these sorts of offenses?
And that 80% increase in low-level arrest, how did the system cope with that much more activity?
Right. And this does lead to your initial question, and I would like to get back to that, but I just wanted to put out there the caveat that wasn't actually the topic of my research. But, you know, one of the most interesting sort of empirical findings about New York, and what leads it to be this puzzle that the book is about, which is entitled Misdemeanor Land, you have, you know, the police chief and mayor and political actors getting out there and saying, this is so important, we have to take low-level offenses very seriously. You've got this sort of this theory, and it's a theory, and that's important to remember. I mean, the Broken Windows article was published in The Atlantic in 1982, and it doesn't really start to get operationalized until the early 90s, and it really is, you know, New York is the test case, right, the petri dish where this is happening. And so nobody knows what works, right? I mean, the increase in crime that started in the late 60s, it really went to the 70s, and then, you know, that took off again in the early 90s with violent crime and the crack epidemic. No one really knows what caused this major increase in crime. There's all sorts of theories, but anyone that tells you they understand what was really behind that is just, you know, sort of inflating their own importance. And let me tell you something else. No one knows what caused the great crime decline in the U.S., much less in New York. And by the time Broken Windows was really rolled out in the early 90s, crime had hit its peak and was starting to decline. So violent and property crime really peaked 89, 90, and had gone down for about 4 years by the time Bill Bratton, who was New York City's police chief under Mayor Giuliani for the first 2 years, that really initiated these Broken Windows tactics. I mean, it had already been declining at a pretty important rate already for 4 years. So, you know, they introduced this model, but what's interesting is because no one really thinks about what's going to happen once these cases hit court, and because there's a lot more political support and salience to increasing police, and the actual numbers of the police force have gone up, actually under the prior mayor, under Dinkins. So you've got more police out there making arrests. They have this imperative, this theory, this model now that if you make a lot of low-level arrests, you're going to do something positive for the city in various ways. But it's not as sexy to fund courts, right, or to fund clerks, or to fund judges, or to fund public defenders' offices, or DA's offices even. So what you have is basically a system overload story. I mean, you have the courts being flooded with these cases without a parallel increase in resources to basically do what we think courts do with criminal cases, which is adjudicate them, which is look at the accusation and determine whether or not the person committed the alleged crime. But a point that I make in the book is that it's also important to remember that misdemeanor crimes just have a different social standing. They have a different social meaning. And so prior to Broken Windows, most people in the courts and in police just thought of these as piddly cases that no one really cared about, right? The real things that people cared about were murder and assault and rape and, you know, carjacking and property crime, burglary, robbery, right? These are the things that sort of elicit social fear, right?
Yeah, I've heard police refer to these as things that keep them from really solving serious crimes. I mean, they look at them with disdain a lot of times.
Right. I mean, it seems sort of below their professional rank, right, to be caring about people pissing on the sidewalk or stealing a candy bar. It's sort of an insult to their, you know, crime-fighting, you know,
their self-worth, yeah.
Exactly. Sense of professional value and valor even, right? Now, what's interesting about the Broken Windows theory is it sort of turns it on its head. I mean, the Broken Windows theory is that, A, that's what the public cares about. The public cares about order. And, B, that there's this mechanism by which allowing low-level crimes to persist authorizes people to engage in major crime, right? It sort of brings about this sort of social environment where people think, well, if nobody's enforcing unlicensed vending on the sidewalk, then I guess I could go about, you know, stealing things or breaking windows, right? I mean, that's the theory. And again, right, it's a theory because, you know, take it from someone who studies causality and social science for a living. It's very hard to establish this stuff, you know, and so it tries to flip that and say, you know, that this is important. But what's interesting is what ended up happening in New York is you basically saw the criminal conviction rate go in half and the dismissal rate just soar. So currently in New York City, less than half of the misdemeanor arrests on an annual basis result in any form of conviction. And the majority of the cases that do result in a conviction of any sort, so about 50% are being dismissed in one form or another. And there's multiple forms of dismissal. But the other half results in some form of conviction, and the majority of those convictions are to what are called non-criminal offenses, which is basically disorderly conduct, right? It's a violation, it's not a crime. And it's essentially used as a way of just keeping tabs on people. There's no prospective jail sentence. There's often no sentence at all. It's just what's called a conditional discharge. The requirement is, well, don't get arrested again, and we're just going to sort of put this little mark on you and then send you back into the community. But 50% of the cases are dismissed, and maybe less than 20% results in a criminal conviction. And the story is you really only end up with a criminal conviction after you've been arrested multiple times. You've been given sort of these conditional dismissals. And so, you know, my argument is that if we want to understand the misdemeanor system, at least in a city like New York that has intensive policing over certain spaces, it's much more about engaging and hassling and marking and engaging these sort of low-level forms of social control while people still live in their communities and their neighborhoods than it is about the way that we've understood mass incarceration, which is to remove people permanently or for long periods of time into these totally controlled institutions of prisons where they are often traumatized by those types of experiences and then come back with a permanent record that they have to manage throughout their life. Now, that's not to say that these aren't very important and often incredibly harmful encounters. It's just that we have to understand that it works very differently, right? And I think we've started to see some of this from the studies in Ferguson, you know, that talked about how intense that there's certain communities are just constantly burdened with police encounters, stops, fines and fees. It's just a very different way, and it shows in some ways that what you have is a criminal justice system that's just very interwoven with certain people's lives as this back and forth type of ongoing obligation as opposed to an encounter that results in a removal to prison that then the person has to, you know, adjust when they come back into the community.
You've and others have described this as sort of a managerial justice.
Mm-hmm.
What do we mean by managerial justice?
I mean that I think if we want to understand the way, the role, this component of the criminal justice system, it's that it's essentially a form of widespread social control over entire spaces and populations. And New York, like most major American cities, is highly segregated by race, ethnicity, and class. And so the history of, you know, racial and ethnic groups in almost every major city is that there was state-imposed or sanctioned segregation, that there was keeping people from choice jobs and occupations, intentional disinvestment from schools and other positive institutions. So Black and Hispanic neighborhoods in most cities have high crime for the precise reasons that they are also segregated, right? I mean, so there's no sort of separating those two things. And what this form of policing essentially is a decision that instead of doing what states can do and that have often done, you know, which is engage in sort of positive forms of social control, right? If you think about schools or families or job training programs, I mean, those are social control in the sense of it's trying to integrate people into mainstream institutions, give them opportunities, instill a certain set of norms that people share and that regulate shared life. It's just that we think those forms of social control are benign and indeed positive and the types that we want, right? It's how you actually make a society. But criminal justice is another form of social control. And what I think I take from this experiment is that we've essentially decided that it's okay to regulate entire populations with what's essentially a punitive form of social control. And it's different than mass incarceration. It's actually much broader. It's much larger populations of people that are touched by this. And it's a form of intensive policing, a constant suspicion, of essentially, for young men of color. And then this requirement to go back and forth to courts to sort of prove that you are a governable person, that you're the type of person that can show up to court. And that's what's really different about misdemeanor courts. It's so interesting. It's not adjudicating on the basis of, oh, I want to know, did you in fact jump the turnstile and not pay, you know, $2.75 for to enter the subway? Instead, what's happening is they're saying, well, you know, what I want to know is, will you show up to court? Are you the type of person that I can trust that I don't have to worry about, right?
In many ways, that's kind of assumed. That's not adjudicated. It's already assumed that that's happened. And so it's now to the next steps. Will you continue to show up to court? Will you go through all these hassles we put you through?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think what's interesting is, you know, the argument that I make, and I know some people, you know, some people say that there's a presumption of guilt. And I say, you know, it's almost broader than that. I think what's fascinating about some of these low-level courts is the fact that guilt and innocence have actually just become divorced from the very daily operations of the institution. So it's, what's even more radical is it's like they don't even have time to ask if you're guilty or not. I mean, we're talking about a system at the high point of misdemeanor arrests in New York City, there was about 250,000, so 250,000 misdemeanor arrests were actually processed every year. And the grand majority of those went to final disposition at arraignments. So arraignments is the very first court appearance that you have, you know, after being arrested. And in New York, it's within 24 hours. So what that means is, this, you know, the police have accused you of a crime, right, a crime that can fundamentally change your status in the world. They've put you in handcuffs. They put you in a squad car. They put you in a squalid holding cell. And the state has brought down its, you know, heavy machinery of criminal law to, you know, to accuse one of its citizens of wrongdoing. And within less than 24 hours, the entire legal case is over. And at that point, you've got to remember, all you have is police paperwork, a cut and pasted complaint, people have flipped through that paperwork for somewhere between, you know, 40 seconds and 2 minutes. You've got maybe somewhere between 80 to 150 cases on the calendar on an arraignment shift in 7 hours of court time. I mean, anyone that tells you that that's adjudicating on the facts is just delusional. Of course it's not. They're essentially saying, I don't know if you did it, and I don't know if I care, but I am going to demand something of you, and I'm going to demand that you are marked temporarily, that you have to sort of perform, that you're a good person for me. And I think that the reason that we're comfortable doing that is essentially because we're comfortable doing it to the type of people that we do it to, you know, which are essentially young men of color, people who live in poor neighborhoods, who have some of the lowest voting rates in the city for DA or for governor or for mayor even. And they don't have the political capital to sort of demand a different form of investment in their neighborhoods, which would be the more positive forms of social control, like jobs and better schools and things that would really transform the conditions that actually give rise to crime and disorder, as opposed to simply sort of control the upshots, the inevitability of those things happening in poor and marginalized places.
My guest today is Isa Coleman Halseman. She's an associate professor of both law and sociology at the Yale Law School and Yale University concurrently. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Misdemeanor Land, which will be out this spring. And she'll be giving the 10th Stephanie Seymour Lecture in Law at the University of Tulsa College Law on Detecting Discrimination, Some Thoughts on Theory and Method. She'll be speaking Thursday evening at 6 o'clock at the law school. Well, let's take it to the next step. You've talked about how it's disproportionately people of color. When you look at the statistics, yes, it's pretty blatant. Let's talk about the idea of selective law enforcement. Is it in certain socioeconomic and ethnic communities where these misdemeanor, this high level of misdemeanor focus took place?
Right. I mean, that's a great question. And I think this is one of the hardest things that we have to grapple with, both in the law, as social scientists, and really morally as citizens, I think, that, you know, that care about equality, but also care about really serious things like high crime or disorder that make living in cities difficult or hard. So let me just start by saying nobody likes crime. People that live in poor neighborhoods don't like crime. People that live in rich neighborhoods don't like crime. African-American communities don't like crime. White communities don't like crime. Hispanic communities don't like crime. Asian communities don't like crime. Nobody likes crime. And anyone that starts this conversation really has to, you know, start from that premise that it's that these things are serious, that violent crime is serious, it causes profound harms to communities, to people, to individuals, to lives, to families, and that the state has a positive obligation to control violence, to control, in fact, that is, most theories of the state is that that's the primary obligation of the state, to control interpersonal violence by having the monopoly on violence, right? Armies, mm-hmm. police, that's the state trying to control violence. And so that's a legitimate function, and I want to be very clear that that's something that I believe. But I think we have to go from there and ask then, what are the ways that a state can control violence, can address these things? And it's just important to remember that there's many, many ways a state can do that, only one of which is policing, only one of which with the criminal justice system, only one of which is with punishment. And even if you think the punishment is legitimate, which I do in many cases, you have to ask, to what extent and what role punishment is playing in integrating people back into the social fabric as opposed to constantly marginalizing them. So it certainly is true that one legitimate reason that we would think to have concentrated police forces in certain spaces is that there's high crime in those spaces. And I think that's something that both people that often, for the most part, people that live in those communities and public that votes that often doesn't live in those communities thinks. But the question is how you do it and what else the state is doing, right? And so in New York, I'm sure some of your listeners have heard about the Stop, Question, and Frisk issue where yes. this police were engaging in a huge numbers of what are called Terry stops, which is a Supreme Court case that authorizes investigatory stops. And at the high point, there was something, I think, close to 700,000 of these a year. And they're almost exclusively in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. And the police said that this was a investigatory, this was a tool to keep down crime, to look for guns. And that may be true, or it may be that it was also that particular way of engaging policing was politically acceptable because the communities that were affected by it lacked the political power to demand a more respectful, a more carefully tailored form of policing. And essentially, I think that's what you see in a lot of cities that rely on high levels of stops and misdemeanor arrests, which is there may be a legitimate role, but the intensity of it and the way in which it's carried out, whether or not it's respectful, whether or not reasons are given, whether or not the stops are carefully tailored and actually limited as to when there's sufficient suspicion to engage in the stop or the arrest or the search, there's just no way of divorcing the types of things that we accept in policing from the sort of social and political status of the people that it affects. And that, I think, is the heart of what we need to think about when we ask is whether or not something is discriminatory. Because it's not that these things don't have functions. Of course they have legitimate functions. But the question is, why are we choosing exclusively criminal justice, punitive, often degrading forms of social control as opposed to more integrating forms of social control like schools or work programs or support for families that are in poverty, as opposed to intensive policing, which often involves degrading encounters with the state, especially for people who already don't have political power, that aren't the ones that vote, that aren't the ones that donate money to campaigns, that aren't the ones that have access to elites and to politicians. And so to me, that's, I think, the way that we really need to think about this, I think both morally and legally, that we have to ask if the state is narrowly tailoring its uses of these tactics, given the fact that they necessarily always will fall more heavily on the most disadvantaged, because that's, of course, where you see crime. It's just, that's just the social fact. Since the beginning of time, there's more crime in poor and disadvantaged spaces. Go across societies, across historical periods, that's always the case. And so for me, discrimination is often a question of political and social power.
Let me ask you another question. And certainly the proliferation of phone videos, dash cams, body cams, and this sort of instant filming of a lot of these everyday encounters has certainly accelerated the number of questions about these techniques. I'm wondering, has the effects of the release of these videos had some mitigating factor in how these encounters are happening? Are new questions being asked about how police are policing when they have these encounters?
That's a great question. I'm no expert in that realm, but I'll, you know, sort of give you my impressions as an informed citizen that studies criminal justice in general, which is that I think of the videos sort of the way that I think about the role of broadcast media in the civil rights era. Most of white America, I think, or people who live in more privileged spaces, or spaces that, even if they're not privileged spaces, are spaces where the state and people in authority start the encounter with the presumption of humanity and civility, and that the police officer is encountering deserves a measure of respect and concern and isn't automatically sort of just assumed to be a scary, threatening human being, right? And that's really the crux of what we think of when we think of discrimination, which is no one has to intend it. You don't have to be a bad actor, right? I mean, we live in a very racialized society where the meanings about different groups entail some sort of assumption about that certain types of people are scary or threatening, and it's very hard to get behind that, right? I mean, that's sort of what's sometimes called implicit bias, or just frankly the stereotypes of what groups are. And I think that many people who haven't lived in that way, that haven't had their very person subject to those sorts of assumptions, it's hard to believe how common or how frequent or that these things actually happen. Because we want to think that people with positions of power, like police officers, are good people. Many of them are, of course, but it's very hard to believe just how frequent and how common these things are. And so I think that the role of these videos is that it's sort of made it hard for people to deny anymore just how pervasive and how serious and how scary these types of encounters are, how quickly those assumptions move from an assumption to fatal or near fatal action to violence. And so it was like the role of seeing what the police were capable of doing in the Jim Crow South during the civil rights era. I mean, I think that large swaths of America had to suddenly face what we were willing to do and what the racial order required and entailed, and they became very uncomfortable with that, and that sort of created a moral imperative. And I hope that we might see the same thing here, and this comes back to my argument as to why, in some sense, I think asking, well, it's not discrimination because the police are just engaging in these tactics in high-crime neighborhoods, and it just so happens that high-crime neighborhoods are also Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. Well, the point is, when we rely on the state to create social order only with punitive penal mechanisms, you reproduce this meaning that people who live in those spaces are criminal people and that they're under an ongoing obligation to prove that they're not. And when you create those types of meanings, you put everyone, including police officers, who I think probably don't want to be put in that space, of having these understandings and these sort of mental structures that trigger fear and violence constantly.
Are there any sense that some of these communities are rethinking this idea of large misdemeanor enforcement, or at least thinking about rethinking it?
You know, you certainly see that in New York. There's been a lot of, I don't want to sound discouraged in saying that they are, small reforms, because they're not small. It's important, it's incremental. But I think that we have gotten to this place through what I call political and moral judgments, again, which is that it's okay and that we find it acceptable to maintain order over some people in some places through these mechanisms as opposed to others, right? And so saying that we're going to defer prosecution on these type of cases or hold open in abeyance a certain, some small number of these cases is really not reckoning with this much larger question, which is, what do we owe people above and beyond just controlling them in a democratic society? So I do think that there's a lot of rethinking, but, you see a lot of pushback on this use of fines and fees at the municipal level in a lot of cities and municipalities that have heavy reliance on low-level arrests and fines and fees, and you see a pushback in New York, but this is a political issue. It's not a technocratic one. It's entirely unclear the role that this form of policing played in bringing down crime in New York. There's absolutely no question that crime went down in New York, serious crime, and that is an important good that benefits, first and foremost, people that live in the highest crime communities and spaces. However, nobody knows the real reason, and anyone that tells you that they do, is running for office or lying, which is unfortunately often the same thing. But it's unknown, and we engage in all sorts of experiments, and the type of experiments that we're willing to engage in tells us something about how we value the people in our shared political community. And I think that we will only really rethink these tactics when the people that are most affected are organized, are politically active, are making demands, and are saying, this is what I want. This is what I want from the state. This is how I want to be protected.
Issa Coleman-Houseman, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Issa Coleman-Houseman is an associate professor of law and of sociology at the Yale Law School and Yale University, respectively. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Misdemeanor Land, Criminal Courts and Social Control in an Age of Broken Windows. It's published by the University of Princeton Press. She'll be giving the 10th Stephanie Seymour Lecture in Law at the University of Tulsa College of Law Thursday evening at 6 o'clock. That lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.